It's Wednesday, August 3rd, 2011, and you're listening to episode 242 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Mikey.
This is Wayne.
And this is Johan.
I can't believe it. I just had to turn Pat down. Wow. Okay, sometimes setting mic levels is a little more interesting than other times. I'm sure it's probably never exciting for you guys, so let's dig into what we got going on here today. We have Mikey Mason joining us again, and woo! Mikey, we just got to listen to a first cut of your album, Impotent Nerd Rage. Yes, which includes the love song to Unicron that I commissioned. So give us an update on where you're at and what's coming up next and how soon before people can actually get their hands on this.
I am going to, and this is a guess, this is mere speculation. I don't want to insult you by giving it a specific or hard date, and as soon as I have one, I'll put it out there. End of August, hopefully sooner. But I will say right now, end of August.
If you make it by August 23rd, my wife can buy it for me for my birthday. Just saying.
And August 24th is Clan Founding Day, for whatever that's worth to you.
And August 25th is Gene Simmons' birthday.
Wow, so there's a whole run of stuff. You've got Wayne,
he's going to get married now.
Gene Simmons.
Yeah.
So it's a series of ups and downs. Let you guys decide which ones are the ups and downs. But all right, so you got about 2 more weeks of studio work to do?
Studio work is done. We're in the mixing phase. Okay. I just got back the second batch of mixes,
so it's just mixing and mastering and all that slightness.
I took notes on them, sent them back today, so however long that takes to get those back.
Yeah.
And then probably the next step after that's mastering. Production art's being done right now. It'll be available on iTunes through TuneCore. It'll be available from my website if you want to buy the physical CD, and it'll be available on Bandcamp if you want to digitally download, and I'll possibly be working on some extras that you can download through Bandcamp as well.
Yeah, and we'll get all that information, of course, here on the show and then in the show notes once it's available. But I'm just excited because we got to hear some
nearly done
studio work, and I gotta say the production quality on this is great. I mean, when you perform this at Fear the Con, especially with the talking parts between it, it's funny stuff, but when you actually hear it with all the different instrumentation and all the different vocals and all that stuff done at a studio level, it's just a great product overall.
Well, thank you.
And I cannot wait to see this one get out there and to, I mean, really, quite frankly, get the recognition that we believe it deserves. So
it was bizarre watching, because you guys obviously can't see, but, you know, there are five of us in the Fear the Boot studio complex. And they're sitting around with headphones on, and I didn't have headphones on, and I'm watching them listen to it, and I can't hear it. So every, you know, I'm just sitting there watching them. They're smiling, and all of a sudden laughing all together, and then smiling, and then laughing all together. And it was a great feeling.
It's like a shared delusion.
It was. But it reinforced one of the things that I've held true for a long time, that people laughing makes you laugh, which is why when you go to a comedy show, you should all laugh as loud as you can, because I can't hear what the hell they're laughing at. I know what song they're at. I can only speculate
right
at what line you're at based on where I see the track
on Alan Moore's beard. There doesn't have to be any specific line. I think the entire premise of the song is hilarious, because quite frankly, I really do believe what's described in that song is probably how Alan Moore himself spends an average day.
Which is why he gets grumpy when his beard runs off.
Yeah. I think my favorite is My Next Girlfriend, Just Like You. Awesome song.
It's like Bowling for Soup wrote a song for my album, actually.
Yeah. It's got a great chorus, too. I'm still fantasizing about it, actually.
Thank you. I have to say, I Love You for Your Brain was my favorite.
Your Brain Turns Me On.
Your Brain Turns Me On. That was it.
Let's move on to something that you guys can hear more immediately, which is us talking about role-playing games. And
no, let's just keep talking about music that they haven't heard yet. Yeah. I think we can fill an hour with this.
I was saying, unless Mikey's going to allow me to tag the entire CD onto the end of the episode. But somehow I doubt, given the fact that he's trying to monetize this.
Yeah,
so instead, what we will do is we will cut on to something that you guys can more immediately associate with. Though I do hope when this comes out, you guys will at least give his stuff a run, because I've got to say, I just listened to it and I enjoyed it. I mean,
oh yeah, hell of a good stuff.
Yeah. So let's move into another subject about comedy, which is, Wayne, you threw something out there. Do you want to set this up or do you want me to set it up?
Framing this, right now I'm in a superhero game over Skype with the other guys from over at Funny Books. And my main character is far more comedic than the rest of the group. All the other superheroes are darker superheroes. Some of them even fall under anti-superheroes. But I'm kind of the comedic value of the group, because every supergroup has that guy that is the high energy, obnoxious character. So far, I think it's going very well, and people can judge that on their own. But I have this fear of crossing the line. So I'm curious for advice on how to do the comedic character without being the obnoxious player.
Let me first put something out here that I don't know we have actually done yet on this show, which is, let's go ahead and give the name of the game you're playing in, and I'll provide a link to this in the show notes. It is not produced by this podcast. As he said, it's produced by Funny Books with Aaron and Polly. I still don't know why it's not Aaron, Polly, and Wayne. But
because they'd have to change all the tabs on everything in iTunes, and they already have so many episodes that it would be a lot.
Yeah, fair enough. If we were to change our brand name, I'm sure we'd probably lose half the audience in confusion, and so therefore we're not going to do that. So, okay, but
the game is called Knights of Rainsboro, and we're releasing it as an actual play as well, and it's over on the ideologyofmadness.com website.
And I'll provide a link to this in the show notes. So if you want to hear an actual play, doesn't involve all of our hosts, just involves Wayne, but nonetheless, if you want to hear Wayne's actual play that he's referring to, we'll give you the link to that. Now, to your question, that you gave another example from comic books, which is like, for example, you have X-Men, but Spider-Man's tagging along.
Yeah, or Spider-Man in the Avengers, Flash in Justice League. You can point to pretty much any superhero team, and you can point to that one guy.
Johnny Storm in the Fantastic Four.
Exactly. One person is going to be the more obnoxious character. I think to have a good, rounded out, interesting group for a superhero story, it may not be necessary, but it really helps.
Let's not just keep this to superhero stories. Within any group of people, everyone's got different attitudes, everyone's got different quirks, everyone has different ways of coping with stress. How do you play a character who is lighthearted, comedic, wisecracking, etc., without that character becoming a disruption to the group? We're presuming here this is not a comedy game. Because if it's right. a comedy game, then obviously you fit right in. Mm-hmm. We are presuming that the rest of the group is trying to have at least a semi-serious game. Some negative examples of this I have seen, and I'll then kind of bridge this off of one where I reformed one of my own characters. But negative examples is part of the reason I freaking hate Kender characters is because every Dragonlance game I played in, somebody had to play Kender, and they thought they were a whole hell of a lot more funny than they really were. And it just drug the game down. They mm-hmm. became distracting. They became spotlight hogging. I mean, you'd be trying to have any type of a serious moment, and it's just somehow they just had to make a joke. And, you know, truth be told, I think it was almost worse when they were genuinely funny. Because when they're annoying, at least you can stay in character with kind of the brooding attitude of the moment. When they're genuinely funny, it's even harder.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that people run into is they just try too damn hard to be funny in playing a character like this. Like with a Kender, for example, you're saddled with this notion that, oh my God, I have to perform. I have to be funny all the time. And that's really not the case. I mean, in all these groups that you're talking about, like the superhero groups, the reason it works is it's scripted. Yeah, this is, you know, this has been written by writers that know their shit. So that's what makes it funny. It's, you would know, Mikey. Well, I mean, no, you know, there's an art to comedy.
When you say it's scripted,
what the heck does he know about comedy?
Nothing. Not a thing. But when you say it's scripted, it falls back to this group template. All right, Flash in the Justice League, even Spider-Man in the New Avengers, as much as that book sucks. I'm just saying, they meant for him to be there.
Right.
They planned for that together. They've got the story arc. So when you're talking about, I mean, it boils down to group template, much as I've never played with a group template. I'm just saying that, I mean, at least group concept, when you're talking about making a group, who do you want to do what, fill what role? And when you're doing that, you need to talk about what is the acceptable amount of smartassery that is allowed to go on.
Yes.
It's just like how fatal is the campaign? It's that important of – and you're talking about in the Knights of Rainsboro, there are all these dark or even anti-heroes. Did you guys talk about what your character is going to be before you made him?
Oh, very much.
Okay. So they knew that you were going to be this glib –
they actually voted for that character.
Okay.
We all voted for each other's characters, and you know, everyone had kind of an input on what everyone else was doing. So we created this group where everyone knew that this was going to be the lighthearted character versus this is going to be the character that if someone gets possessed, they'll shoot him. Right. We knew that going in.
All right. So here's the question then. Have you guys had a discussion about how much is too much?
No.
Well, those are the people you should be asking.
That's a good point. I mean, one thing that I know I've intentionally done is I never try to jump in with anything that the character would do that would be obnoxious when the spotlight's not on the character. Mm. You know, in his moments, that's when he's out there, that's when he's energetic, that's when he's bouncing and obnoxious. If the spotlight's on someone else, I would never intrude.
You guys have tied right into several things that I have to say on the subject, which is, first of all, be a player first. And what I mean by that is you have to accept that there is a group experience that is going on here and recognize as a player out of the game when it is appropriate and inappropriate for this character to behave a certain way.
Because it can really add something to the game.
And I mean, can also really take away from the game.
Exactly. And that's my fear. I've had really good feedback from the other players on how I've been doing it so far, but I don't want to cross that line.
Right. And I think the second one, this is going to depend, of course, on the nature of the character and the nature of the campaign. But the times that I've really seen it flop is when it is just gratuitous. Right. And Mikey and Wayne, that's something you guys are both describing. I think Pat as well, though I would reduce it to a single word of gratuity. They were being comedic, or in some cases I was trying to be comedic, purely for the sake of doing it. There's no rhyme or reason to why the character was this way. There was no rhyme or reason to how this character even fits into the group. This wasn't someone who was being comedic to cope. This wasn't someone who was being comedic to get attention or something like this. It was just this gratuitous thing of whatever's occurring, I have to have a punchline.
Yeah.
Or whatever is going on, I have to be so completely out of whack with what any sensible human being would do that that's my character shtick. And that is just as stupid as any other one-trick pony character.
Well, it's like the druid who won't go in the town.
Yes. Except
you're
instead,
just screw your group up.
You have the character who won't be serious, no matter what's going on.
The other side of that is if you find the balance of when to be, you know, lighthearted and when to shut up. And I think that is the balance, when to be lighthearted and when to shut up. When you decide to be serious with your character, when your character actually has a serious moment, it will have tons more impact than any other time when your character is talking. But that depends on how often you are either glib or shut up, because when you shut up, you let everybody else have the spotlight.
That's an incredible point I'd never even thought about, is that when those serious moments do come, you're right, it'll have way more impact.
One thing that you can use a character like that for, I think, is to help out a little bit with the pacing of the storytelling. I've had a little bit of experience with that in various games where one character wasn't necessarily comic relief, but would often do things that were a little bit on the outrageous side and could kind of jump in and spur the action a little bit when
we refer to that as the Chad.
Right. When players, rather than necessarily the characters, are just kind of low energy and they're run down and it was a long day at work and they're just not getting into the game, the comedy character doing something ridiculous can help get the energy flow going a little bit.
Sure.
And it can also act as kind of a foil for the DM in their storytelling. So if things are getting too serious, they want to bring the tension level back down a little bit so they can ratchet it back up later, they throw a softball to the lighthearted comedy character and let him run off with it, and it kind of bleeds off the tension, which is an important part of any storytelling, is monitoring that rise and flow of the tension levels.
Well, sure.
I think another thing that can really help with this is that it always helps to have somebody to help you out with this, sort of to have a foil. One character being the lighthearted glib guy, the comic relief, is great, but it's kind of hard if you don't have a straight man to play off of. So oftentimes, you know, if you can find, if there's one other person in the group, say, that you can play off of, and you can sort of get into these little conversations or quasi-arguments or whatever, that can kind of, I think, can kind of help it. I definitely have had that experience in role-playing where, you know, I've had interactions with those characters where it's just kind of like, with Flash, there's always the females that are just sort of, ugh, they roll their eyes at him because his continual, you know, come-ons and bad one-liner or his bad pickup lines or whatever.
Or you have the stoic, quiet Batman to be his foil.
Right.
To set him up.
So what we're saying here is every Taz needs his Flint.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
My bad.
No, I'd rather be with it because, I love it.
Something else that I think is worth throwing in here is, prior to the recording, Mikey, you were talking about kinds of comedy. You were talking, for example, about the difference that you see between original comedy versus parody versus filking and things like that, and talking about how kind of how you see.
Oh, you're going to get me in trouble with a filk audience.
Well, that's
or
why I'm not.
They're going to take it the wrong way.
That's why I'm not going to chase this point.
All right.
Because I realize we'd have to have you say it and then spend the next 30 minutes defending it. And then we spend the next 3 episodes apologizing for it. So, here's my point, though. Sometimes it's a matter of just getting the right kind of comedy?
Right.
Is this guy a wise ass? Is this more of a dark comedy? Is it just comedic because it's so out of place? It's so inappropriate. We talked about back in the D&D game that I was playing with my family. My brother-in-law and sister were co-playing a character who had all kinds of developmental disorders. And it wasn't meant to be funny in terms of we were making fun of developmental disorders, but he would oftentimes do very awkward things just because he didn't know what was appropriate.
Right.
And that created a sort of uncomfortable comedy. The character that I was going to bring up that I think illustrates, at least in my mind, the right and wrong way to do this was a character that I played. A guy by the name of Raymond Victor, and he was first put into a sci-fi game that had magic in it. And this was the character that convinced me that the whole Curse of Awesome thing is a myth. I totally buy it after having played this character. The short story is he was immortal as a result of powers he did not ask for. He was not a vampire or anything like that, but he was immortal as a result of powers he did not ask for. And he'd watched everyone he knew die. He was effectively alone. And as a result, the vast majority of conversation and socialization was occurring in his head, because like a guy locked in solitary confinement for 2 years, except in this case it had been 200 years, he just had lost it. And the first time I played this character, he was slapstick, he was obnoxious, everything he did was almost childish in nature, he was just distracting. He was annoying. He was annoying to the other players, and rightfully so. It got to a point where I couldn't keep playing him because even I was getting annoyed by him. Mm. Some time passes. We decide, you know what, we're going to try dusting off some old character concepts. I take this guy out of the trash heap of our gaming pile, decide to rewrite him and rewrite him in more of a dark comedy. Mm. Or, for example, one of the primary elementals that he summons to do his bidding is named after a childhood friend who had died like 2 centuries prior. And he still sees this thing as if it was his childhood friend, despite the fact it's like this 8-foot-tall rock monster. And so there was kind of this weird, distorted comedy to the whole thing, but it suddenly did a much better job of fitting the tone of the game and never distracting from the other things going on. He'd make comments that were utterly inappropriate or out of place, or sometimes would just even fail to get basic socialization because his mind was so gone. And it created funny moments, but it fit within the context of the type of comedy that was appropriate to that game.
Was it the same Game Master?
Yes, actually it was. It was the same Game Master.
Same group?
Same Game Master, same group.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's not a cause then. So then it was you.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was totally me. As we've said many, many times before, Fear of the Buddha is sits atop the mountain of our failures. So, main topic for today is something that has nothing to do with comedy. This was a question that was sent in by a listener named Kyle.
Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Kyle. Thank you for sending in your question, by the way. And for those of you who aren't aware, once in a very rare while, the planets will align in some 2012 fashion, and I will actually read my emails. And Kyle shot me an email. And it goes something like this. A while back, we did...
Dear Penthouse.
I never thought this
what?
Would
okay.
to me.
I'm paying attention now.
And I was on Spankwire.com, and I looked up Ava Devine. And...
Oh, I highly recommend that one.
I do not.
Dan is wrong. Don't and listen
now,
to him.
And now I can't eat the cactus blossom at the Outback Steakhouse.
Dan, do you feel dirty just knowing that was played in your house?
Yes, and I didn't even see it, and I feel dirty knowing it was played in my house.
He just heard it.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, yeah. You are better off. If you do know what I'm talking about,
God bless God you.
You can send your complaints to Mikey at feartheboot.com. Because yeah. That email doesn't exist.
Beyond that, I'm not going to explain. If you enjoy the sort of thing that you would see on rotten.com, go Google this. Otherwise, don't. You will be very pleased you didn't.
It's
so,
not that bad.
No, it's not.
It's very tasteful.
Flavorful. It's very. No, never mind.
Right. Anyway. All right. So Kyle sent in an email, and Kyle raised this question, and I'm not reading from the email here, so let me just kind of paraphrase the question he asked. A while back, we did an episode I think it was a two-parter on dungeon design. We use the term dungeon, but I want to stress right here at the top, when we talk about a dungeon, I am not just talking about abandoned cave haunted by monsters that a group of fantasy adventurers are going through.
Sometimes it's an abandoned castle.
Yeah, it could be an abandoned castle, an abandoned
key. Might be an abandoned spaceship.
A wizard tower. Yeah, all jokes aside, yeah, this could be a spaceship. This could be some sort of facility that your group has entered into and must traverse for one reason or another. And we did a two-parter on how to do what we feel is a better job of designing those environments to be interesting, to be organic, to be believable, to really come alive and have a character of their own. I'll link to that in the show notes just in case anyone's new to the show and has not heard those particular episodes. But Kyle's question was this: even if you have a really well-designed dungeon, how do you actually execute it well at the table? How do you actually make people buy into this and you keep it interesting? Even if you have a really wonderfully designed setup, let's say you're playing a 40K game and you're doing Space Marines going through a Hulk looking for Gene Stealers, and you have just built a great dungeon, which in this case is a Space Hulk, but how do you walk through that room-to-room exploration in a way that doesn't get boring? Because I'll tell you right now, there are tons of game masters, and D&D in particular, but not just D&D, who have lost me on, you come to the end of a hallway, you can go left or right, you hear water to the left, you go left or right, well, you go left. You see a waterfall, it looks like there's a door off this place. You can go back the way you came, go through the door, continue forward, up to the head, it looks like it branches again. And this just goes on and on and on.
I don't remember DMing any games that you were in, Dan. How did you do that imitation? So it was dead on.
And pretty soon, I'm looking on my character sheet to see if I happen to have stone shape, not to defeat any monsters, but just to get the hell out of here, to save myself from boredom.
I think the first question I would have for someone trying to set aside and describe a room is, what is the point of the room?
Well, and, all right. So look, while you're doing that, I want to say that I have a 3-point plan that would cover this whole thing. And that ties directly onto the first point, which is keep it logical. All right.
Are you pitting your numbered list against mine?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go.
Let's compare. Mine only has 3, but they're still bigger than yours.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I got 8.
So. That's great, but they're very small.
Yeah. All right. Let's roll.
All right. So keep it logical. Why is it there? Yes. All right. Give it a reason to be there within the game or, you know, within the game world. A logical reason. Most Space Hulks aren't going to have trap rooms.
Yeah. All right. Dan doesn't have a giant statue of himself in his own living room.
Right. No, actually, that's in the backyard. But,
yeah, it's out of the living room. That's the point. It goes to the backyard.
Nobody can do burnt offerings out in the festival living room.
Right, and that applies.
Smoke.
That applies to the inhabitants or denizens of your dungeon or Space Hulk or whatever. You can't have creatures there that don't have a food source or whatever.
Right.
But keep it logical. Think that your what is the point of the room being there plays directly
now
to that.
Just to check with you, Wayne. Were you actually meaning that, or were you meaning what's the point of this room from a meta out of character? Why am I as a DM putting the players in this room?
I see them both. I see them as really the same question.
Yeah, the answer to that question
because
is yes.
How many times have you sat there? I've done this, certainly in my early days as a GM. I've tried to stop doing it and hope I successfully have, where my goal is simply to make the dungeon big enough to be interesting. I don't even know what that phrase means, but that was what my goal was, to fill the sheet of graph paper.
Right, to give them something to do. They have to have something to do. You have something for them to do. That's why it was there.
Bingo. And so as a result, it had to have a certain number of rooms, a certain number of corridors, because if it was just a straight line with 3 chambers coming off of it, it suddenly didn't make sense to be on graph paper. And therefore, rather than simply saying maybe the dungeon didn't even need to be there at all, I had to justify it by adding branches and corridors and monsters and all kinds of other things that really had nothing to do with the meta purpose or the real purpose of, or the in-character purpose, I guess is a better way of putting it, of the dungeon. The rooms were simply there, going back to the comedy thing, for the sake of gratuity,
right,
to fill out a map. And that's definitely something I would ask is, you know, why, as a game master, are you taking the time to include this room? If there's 30 bedrooms and they're all the same, guess what? You can shorten that to 1 bunking hall. You've just now greatly simplified your spaceship or dungeon or castle or whatever it is, and the players don't have to go through the drudgery of opening 30 separate doors.
Well, I get what you're saying there, but at the same time, if I were going to do this, I think what I would try to do is, if I've got a castle that has 30 bedrooms, to not sacrifice the feel of the size of the castle that we're going through, what I would do maybe is quickly describe the fact that, all right, in your search, you search through two wings and you found nothing. You know, with appropriate flavor text. There's right. a reason yeah. I don't DM. Right. But, you know, you say it in a way that, so you basically, you fast forward them through the boring crap. And then move on to the more interesting things, because then that way, though, you're not saying, oh, well, there's only two bedrooms in this castle. But, you know, there are. But you go through the crap that they're not going to find anything. And I think you can do that as a storyteller.
Or summarize tell what some they story. Do find.
You find some this, that, and the other, you know, non-consequential things, maybe that point you toward the fourth corridor.
Or have them do one find, single you know, search roll, and from that, give them what they found or whatever yeah. so that they feel engaged.
So that you move on to the more yeah. important yeah. things and if you get to the rooms that make sense, like you're saying, the yep. ones that are logical, the ones that matter.
If there are 30 bedrooms and only five of them matter, why are you describing all 30?
Yeah, well, you could just as easily say, along this corridor, you find a series of relatively identical bedrooms, you know, with the personal trappings and possessions and decorations of the people that inhabit them. As you look through these, you find nothing of great significance. But, I mean, you could still put something in there. However, you do see signs of people packing and fleeing rapidly from each of these rooms.
And I think that that's something that – I think that's important for both the GM and the players to sort of get in the habit of doing. Because, like you said before, one of the things that players often are going to do in a dungeon setting is you're going to go room by room – or, you know, whatever, because you don't want to miss the loots.
Right.
You got to get those fat loots, and you don't want to miss something. Because you didn't go to the one goddamn room, and you missed the +5 Holy Avenger because your GM's a dick.
Or you're going to have the character who insists that they search every room for a secret loot. Or you're going to have the one guy, like the thief, who insists on picking everybody's pockets, who insists on searching every room for secret doors right. or whatever. So,
well, and one thing I'd like to kind of caution against is with your point, Dan, that you brought up was you could simplify those 30 rooms into one big bunking hall. Be careful that you don't destroy the in-character realism of your setting by doing stuff like that. If you do that and then you say you're in a spaceship, you neglect to put in the captain's quarters, the first mate's quarters, they're going to spend the whole goddamn day, they're going to tear that ship apart looking for the captain's quarters because that's where the loot's at.
And I absolutely.
And you forgot to put one in.
No, and I do absolutely agree with you that the fact that was actually the second point on my list here is that the
bounty. Point two.
I know. But we'll get to your point too in a minute. Like I said, we're going to throw down here. But I do.
I got three.
I know. We're two down on mine. We'll see where we're at on yours in a second. But. Point being, though, yes, that is absolutely a balancer, is that in the process of eliminating superfluous rooms, you have to be careful about balancing that against the believability of the place. Right. And in your example, the ship, you're absolutely right that maybe you don't want to combine every bedroom down to one giant bunking hall without a really good explanation, but you could consider reducing some of them down that maybe, you know, some of the lower crewmen use four bunk rooms or something like that. And there is absolutely a balance there. But if you can't come up with a good purpose for entire portions of this dungeon to be in the game, then I think that's a sign you need to either eliminate it, shorthand it in terms of design, or shorthand it in terms of description. All right, Mikey, what's your point two?
Point two, variety. All right, so we're talking about that, and we're talking about
my point three.
All right, but we're talking about my variety applies to all sorts of variety. Variety,
his variety has so much more.
My variety has more
than
your variety
does, Dan.
In fact, I even chose the word diversity, which is different than the word variety.
Yeah, I'm just talking. I'm not merely talking about a variety of types of rooms, but you were talking about not undercutting the validity of your environment reality of your environment. But how do you build tension in a movie when they're walking through and nothing's happening? All right, so you lull them into a false sense of security. You'd be able to use that false sense of security to surprise them in one of the bedrooms, all right, by adding variety, which is one reason why you may not want to shortcut all of them. Mm-hmm. All right, another hand is the variety in tension levels, variety in threat levels per room, variety in every aspect of the game. They need to be able to have different challenges, and how you depict the world or the dungeon plays directly into that, I think.
Absolutely, it does. And the way I would kind of suggest, I suppose, shorthanding the dungeon is to decide ahead of time rather than necessarily laying out, you know, on grid paper with rooms and a map, lay out instances and decide these are the instances that I want the party to be involved in. And maybe in some cases that is a room by room search, and you're going to make every single room and corridor in there one of these instances.
Sure.
In other times, it might be East Wing is one instance, and it's going to be one bout of description, one bout of interacting with the players, and then it's done and you move on.
I think a great way to do an exercise in diversity is to go through your house or your apartment, walk through each of the rooms and look at them. Look, they're all yours or whoever it is you live with, but every one of them has a unique character to it. You know, the room we're sitting in right now has a recording setup, has role-playing books, has Furigon the Dragon, has Unicron and his girlfriend RC. You know, there's a story.
He would hurt her so bad.
She'd love it.
Spankwire.com, just look up Ava Devine. Yeah,
that's exactly what he would do to her.
But
talk about.
You go into the very next room next door, and that's the one we loosely call the sewing room. There's a bunk bed in there left over from Carla's childhood. There's a table in there with a sewing machine. There's all of Carla's glassworking stuff that she keeps inside, not in the studio. And that room has different colored walls and a completely different character to it. Mm-hmm. In the same way, even if you have 30 bedrooms, each of those 30 bedrooms is going to have a different occupant, a different character. And I think something I would add on top of that is you can have sort of a macro level of evolution going on throughout the setting. Let's go back to the Space Hulk. Let's say you're working your way up through a place that's increasingly infested. Maybe on the first level, you just find, well, the typical 40K thing of in the year 40,000, no one can afford light bulbs and mops. And by the time you get to the second level up, now you're starting to hear noises. You're finding blood on the floor. You're seeing traces of things. You're seeing tyrannid biomass. I mean, whatever. Then by the third floor, you actually find the infestation or something like that. And that's kind of a ham-fisted example. But you can have this sort of evolving change. Let's say you're in a dungeon. Maybe at the top level, it's a corridor that someone dug, but there's some point where that corridor collapses, and that corridor collapses down into a natural cavern. Mm-hmm. But then beneath that natural cavern, if you follow that far enough, well, eventually, through some water, you find a hidden chamber that somebody was using to hide their stuff, the same way Jesse James used to hide his stuff behind a pool inside Merrimack Caverns here in Missouri.
As you'll see on every billboard you pass.
Yes, as you will see every billboard. You drive down Interstate 44 and count the Merrimack Caverns billboards, and it will
hide out of outlaw Jesse James.
So one issue I've run into with things like that is I've made the mistake of spending so much time designing the, we'll call it dungeon, that I forgot that there's more to the session than just the building they're in.
Right.
So I spend all the time, I had box text for every room that I had handwritten out, and kind of forgot that there really wasn't much going on in that location story-wise.
Yeah.
Spent all this time designing location and just really dropped the ball on the other side of the gaming session, which is the story, the action, the events.
That falls back to why is it here? And why are they here?
Yeah,
they don't have a reason to be there. And I know that if we gloss over an entire chunk of bedrooms and say you find these here, and then they get to another wing, and all of a sudden they go, well, we're going to search these rooms too. And you say, all right, well, which one are you going to search first? All right, we know you just telegraphed a punch to the players. But on the other hand, you just kicked up the suspense level a notch, because now they're on guard.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a use for that. There's a use for glossing it over. There's a use for telegraphing your punch. So you can't ignore plot because the sandbox is just a sandbox. If they don't have a reason to be there, it's not going to be any good.
And I spent all that time figuring out what every room in the building was for and why it was logically there without thinking about the meta side of that. Well, you can't get too focused on either one side or you won't see the big picture.
Yes, and I completely agree with that. I mean, for example, let's take, once again, what's going on right here in real life. Coming into this house, you guys probably know a heck of a lot more about this room than you do most rooms of our house for a simple reason. You're in here for a very specific purpose. There's not as much you need to do in the kitchen. You go in there and grab water. There's something very detailed we're doing in here. Same thing would apply in a game. If there's a place where you find the map room that explains why the castle inhabitants fled and where they went to, obviously there's a lot more detail to that than there's going to be to servant girl number four's quarters.
Yeah.
Something else, though, I think I'd put along those lines is each room has a character story. One of the reasons that box text gets so boring is the fact that box text is all way too damn similar. You're in a rock room. It's this many feet by this many feet. Here's vaguely what you see. Here's the exits. This room exists in a certain way because of a human being who lived here, who had a personality, has a personality, has desires, and was trying to accomplish something with this room. And that is the reason why the box text for this bedroom would be different than the box text for every other room of this house. And keep that in mind when you're doing your dungeons, your spaceships, your castles, your whatever.
My suggestion for dealing with that, at least as kind of a quick hand tool for it, when you're going through these instances, as I call them, where something's going to be going on, something's going to be happening, and you're going to be giving a description, imagine in your head what you're seeing, what you're hearing, the whole nine yards. Write down at least three sensory details from three different senses, and then compare it to the adjacent instances.
Yeah.
And make sure that it's not a duplicate of anything that they would have just done.
Like he's triumphantly holding up three fingers. That was your third point?
This is my third point. Treat your setting as a non-player character. Know it as well as you would know any of your NPCs. And you wouldn't want your bartender, who is the point man maybe for your characters at the local tavern, to be the same as the surly guard, to be the same as the king, to be the same as the evil villain, to be the same as... Because if they're all the same, just like all of your settings, it's going to be boring as crap, and your players are going to yawn. And you do that by engaging the senses.
Right.
All
right.
And some guys, you describe how they smell. Some guys, some NPCs, you describe how they look or how they sound, or how they move, you engage the senses, and every room will have, or could have, every setting could have, should have a different feel.
When they're dealing with the Mad Hermit, you might describe how bad this guy smells. When they're dealing with the bartender, you might instead role play out the way in which he gruffly bickers with his wife.
Or mumbles,
right. And I think absolutely right. That you're looking at these storytelling techniques of appealing to senses. It doesn't always have to be the same senses, but to keep that diversity of description. And just like in a book, more does not equal better. It is the same thing when you are designing the descriptors for these rooms. They don't have to be extremely long and wordy in order to be interesting. In fact, probably the longer you blabber on, unless you're just one hell of a storyteller, you're going to lose your audience.
You know, and one thing someone mentioned, I think it was Johan, to spend more time describing the big map room versus the other rooms. The one thing I think you really have to watch about that, though, is you could be very well telegraphing what the important rooms are. If you gloss over one room but describe another, or the opposite path.
Well, my question is this. If you're a GM, is your job then to obfuscate to the characters what the important rooms are, or is your goal as the GM to help them progress along the path of the plot?
I'm of the mindset if they find that room to be interesting, then that was the important room. Like Dan's bookstore story years ago. I would have thrown something into that bookstore, even if I had never intended it, because the players found that bookstore, I don't know that I'd say interesting based on that story, but that's kind of my mindset is if they latch onto something, if they find it cool, that just became important, whether I intended it to be originally or not.
Bookstore story, please see indices 11GX5 subsection 3. I'll tell you,
did you hear the episode where we came up
with I heard all 15 of the episodes where the bookstore
told. If it was just 15, you did not hear them all, sir.
I know. The one where we came up with a whole new category for you for your next trivia show at Fear the Con.
Which is?
You didn't hear this?
I bet I did.
Okay. Stories we tell too often.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that.
For example, what is the name of the D&D campaign that Chad ran? There's a whole level of trivia.
You mean the one where you guys were in the keep that whole time, just running the keep, that one campaign?
And there was a volcanic ash falling down from the sky and a zombie.
Not the one where the bookstore was, where there were rainbows and stuff. Not that one. No, but the one.
Who was running the game where Chad tried to lie to the group?
Every single one that he plays in.
The great thing about that one is I wasn't even at the table. I think I was the only one around the mics that wasn't. And when we got to it last time we talked about it on the episode, Dan had me actually tell that story.
Yeah.
Because I've heard it so many times
sitting around here that I can tell it just as well as anyone that was sitting there.
But we digress.
So we horribly digress.
In fact, I think I could have corrected you on details, didn't I? I was sitting here too.
But I'm with Mikey on this one. I realize some of this is going to depend on your style as a game master and also the kind of story you're trying to tell. If you're running a really open-ended, sandbox, purely character action-driven sort of game, or maybe not even something quite that extreme, but something of that persuasion, then yeah, maybe what's worth describing is the things that they find interesting. But I'm with Mike in this one. That is a game master who comes to the game not with a railroad, but with plot points and characters and discoveries and twists and turns I want them to discover. If I draw their attention to a room and it's super ham-fisted, or it was supposed to be something that they stumble across unexpectedly, for the sake of creating the right kind of story, yes, I have to be careful about not, to use your phrase, telegraphing that punch. Right. I have to make it feel like this was an accidental, unexpected discovery. However, if they went into the ship to try and find the star charts explaining where this ship came from and why it's adrift, I don't know that I really care to slow them down by making them go room by room, corridor by corridor, through a 25-mile-long warship to find that damned map.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that that really boils down to what we've been saying the whole time, which is understand the purpose out of game for each place you're going to describe, the meta purpose. And if you want the discovery of the map room to be like a surprise and, oh, we finally found it and what a great coincidence this was, then that suddenly gives the last 20 rooms that they found their meta purpose. Right. Their purpose there is to obfuscate the map room, you know, and design them appropriately. I mean, do it however you think you can make the
just know that if you design them all exactly the same, the players will probably find it more tedious than engaging.
And then they will watch The Simpsons instead.
That could happen.
Or the curveball I threw Chad in a game he was running for us, and I just walked outside the ship in a spacesuit.
I think Johan's concept of looking at his instances, because that's what I want. What encounters? And that's true when you talk about encounters. When I talk about treating it like a non-player character, what encounters do you want them to have with the environment? All right, so that sets what's important. And yeah, you're going to telegraph your punches, all right? But on the other hand, there's a certain level of trust and expectation that the players and the GM have together. And just by doing that, just by starting to put a little bit more detail, all right, of a sudden your characters start paying a little more attention because they're, hey, we're somewhere important. And they don't necessarily have to be somewhere important, merely somewhere dangerous.
And of course, when I'm DMing, every room is its own instance because they all have the meta purpose of giving me an excuse to make a roll on the random encounter table.
Oh, I thought they gave you the excuse to kill the characters.
That's where I thought you were going to.
It falls back. I mean, I think that my 3-point plan clearly states. No, but if it's logical, if it has a variety of threat levels, of challenges, and of challenge levels, and then if you treat your environment as an NPC, so you know its purpose and you know its personality or characteristics, and you know what the important encounters you want your characters to have therein are, you can still have your sandbox rooms and let them explore all they want. But you're going to have a much more cohesive and better environment for your characters.
And if that's the angle you want to go, the two things that I'd recommend is, first off, start going through your collection of fiction. You will probably find at least one author in there somewhere who is really good at describing setting. Take those portions where the setting really comes alive to you, dissect them. See point by point, what is this person doing? What senses are they appealing to? What kind of words are they using? What are they explaining in great detail versus glossing over? Start dissecting mechanically how it is that they're approaching it. And the second thing is, observe your world. I talked about walking through your house and looking at each of the rooms. Sure. You can do this with people. You can do this with places. Go to the mall. A mall, quite frankly, is a great big place that has nothing but 30, 40, 50, 100 different stores that walking past in a hurry, if you're going somewhere, really all start to look the same.
But hundreds of NPCs walking around.
That's just how Wayne sees
them. But stop for a minute and look at the people that are walking by and try to think, if I was going to describe this person as a character, how would I describe them to my gaming group? Yeah. If I was going to describe this store I'm walking past right now to my gaming group, what are some words I would use? What are the things that pop out to me about it? It has a dark wooden floor, which clashes sharply with the white tiles of the rest of the mall. It's much more dimly lit and trying to convey a sort of foreboding feel. And you notice a lot of leather and chains, and welcome to Hot Topic. You know, and it's,
also,
and then you realize
really
it's
important.
Merely annoying.
Yes. It's really important as well to try to identify how many experience points the clerk is worth.
That is great.
So
No, another thing you could do that I think is at the end of the day, I mean, if you just don't think about it during the day, but at the end of the day, think back to three people that you talked to, encountered, observed in any way, shape, or form that you don't normally have contact with. And then ask yourself, why do I remember that? Why does that stick out to me? What was different about that that I remember them more than the other 3,000 or whatever people that I probably came in contact, at least in some brief way, with today? And that will give you some clue as to what will stick in your characters' heads, too.
You know, I think if this is something you're really struggling with, if it's you're having a problem making the rooms pop, explaining them to the players, maybe try a couple exercises. So being someone that enjoys writing, I do writing exercises to describe rooms. And then, you know, hand that writing exercise to someone else and see what they got out of it. Mm-hmm. Have someone, you know, that can draw, give them this and say, okay, how would you draw this the way I described it? And you can kind of see how your words are being interpreted by other people.
You guys have sort of hit on something that I really have found that I liked in the past. And I'm a very visual person. I like sort of representational aspects of the game. And this is where I differ a lot with certain members of this group, Chad especially. I grew up playing with miniatures and a lot of other things for setting. One of my favorite things that we ever played with were the dungeon stones. I think it was Dwarven Forge.
Those are awesome.
Made
those
a
are
lot
expensive.
Now that's the downside. Expensive. They're expensive, so this isn't for everybody. But if you're lucky enough to have that kind of thing, and that's an expensive one. But there are also other things that you can get that we used a lot. There were a lot of I'll call them kibble miniatures that you can get. It was essentially like a bedroom set. It was beds, tables, stools. It was a barkeep set. It had tables. It had a bar. It sort of bar had wine bottles. All this kind of stuff, just little things, but you would be amazed at how much that really drew me into the setting. Because what we would do is we had the typical battle mat where we draw out with markers sort of the room, the walls, dimensions and everything. But then you put the tables in, you put the bar in, you put the bed in over, you put the table in the bedroom. All of a sudden, I don't need you, Dan,
right,
to tell me that I'm in a bedroom because I can see it. And not only do I see it, I see where the bed is. I see that it's here. I see that over here in the corner, there's the table with papers on it, or, you know, a candelabra or whatever else like that. Or in the dungeon, one of the things that we used to do, and I think this kind of goes back to how do you make it more interesting instead of saying you come to a corridor, you can go right or left. We got to the point where, okay, we knew something was, we were going to go into a dungeon setting like an underground cavern using these like the Dwarven Forge things. Well, at that point, the GM said, oh, all right, it's time to build the dungeon. And we got all the blocks and every member of the table, we just sat down and we started building a dungeon with the corridors there. So we saw what was going on, but then once it was all done, then we sat down to it and the GM could take over from there. You've already got the dungeon laid out. You don't know what's in it. He does, knows where it's going to be.
And even
so, then you can start going through it. And again, with your miniatures, you're walking down these corridors and you're seeing this represented in front of you. And it helps in the fact that you don't have to describe everything. You can, because, you know, the visual perception goes a long way to the story and everything else like that. So that coupled with a little bit of prompting from the GM, you know, setting it up, I think is wonderful. Well, I had some wonderful experiences with that. Again, I know it's not for everybody, but for me it is. I really miss that kind of thing. And it doesn't even have to be expensive stuff. You know, you can find stuff around. I know they're making a lot of things with paper, you know, like paper models. You can print out, fold them up and have. You can have the whole town setting. You can set up a small town with little buildings here, and then you can drill down into like to the, you know, to the tavern and do that. It helps. It helps me a lot.
And do
it. Show's over. Thanks, everyone.
Pat is proud of himself for just talking.
We sit dumbstruck from this verbal tirade from Pat. We're just sitting here slack-jawed in amazement, and he's like, he looks at us at the end of it, he's like, ta-da!
Honestly, I don't even know what he's talking about. I don't remember
blah, blah,
at all.
Blah, 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 blah. Ta-da!
Pat, I think you've onto something that's very important here, which is the fact that one of the things that is generally missing from most RPGs is a truly visual element. That the RPG hobby is primarily a verbal art form. And there's nothing wrong with that. And one of the things that you can do with those miniatures, whether you take the expensive Dwarven Forge stuff, you go the really cheap route of, you know, getting the little paper ones, or even just start scavenging through things like model railroad sets or even dollhouses. And I'm not talking like the Barbie ones. I'm talking like the more serious ones where people try to...
Why is this dungeon pink?
why because we're trying to kill Paris Hilton.
Why does the Demulich have a Corvette?
But why wouldn't he have a Corvette?
That's the real question.
And Skipper.
But the thing that never gets eliminated from that is the GM's ability to describe the other senses. That, okay, even if I put down a bed and a table and two chairs, maybe you see that, but what I can talk about is you smell the lingering smell of smoke in here, like someone had just extinguished the candle that you see sitting on the table. You hear this in the distance. There are elements that you can still bring alive.
Yeah.
Let's say for a minute that your group is not into the maps or you don't want to deal with that. This still doesn't stop you from using other visual aids. Come in with just pictures. If you can find a particular shot of a grand hall of a real castle in Europe or whatever that really looks like what you're going for, or flipping through a fantasy art book, you see something that really looks like it. You know, have a little packet as a game master and say, okay, you guys finally make it to the edge of the shattered city and you put down a picture of something taken from, I don't know, Fallout or whatever. And it's like, and this is the scene that you see before you. And okay, here I'm describing a macro setting, but within the micro setting do as well. You know, you walk into a command center that looks something like this, and you just do a Google search for sci-fi art bridge or something like that. And you'll find something you can put down to give them something to latch onto. You don't have to take that approach, but this is just something else that you can consider adding to your repertoire of tools.
You know, at FearTheCon 3, that's actually something that helped me. When I was running the Skies of Glass game, I ran the same game for two different groups. The first group, I didn't use anything at all visually. And there were times where you had to go back and re-explain, no, this building's here, or this is the path this way. So for the second group, running the same story through, all I did was I took a piece of paper and I drew simple line drawings. And that alone was enough for them to better visualize what I was trying to describe without needing, you know, a full picture or details. Sometimes just a sheet of paper and a line helps.
And let me say this. When I was in college, I took a stage makeup class. All right. It was part of my theater minor. And one of the things we had to do was create what we called a morgue. Now, in a stage makeup class, you are generally trying to portray all different kinds of characters. So I had to find all these different interesting faces to put together and aspects of the faces that I could use as inspiration to build a makeup set for a particular character, depending on what I was looking for. And it's just something to look through. And what you're talking about, Dan, is essentially possibly building a morgue. When they find an interesting picture of a setting, a landscape, a building, an architecture, a window, an object that they think is interesting that they might use as inspiration or as a substitute to describe, or, you know, an animal, a horse, whatever, armor, a sword, anything. They can take it, cut it out, print it out, whatever, put it in a book,
right,
a notebook. Mm-hmm. And then when you're going through and building your world or whatever and you want some inspiration for, or even maps, like, I used to look at maps of castles, actual medieval castles, because the one thing that only my game had that none of my friends' game had were privies. You could wind up in the bathroom.
Yeah.
All right. And this was still at the point where, you know, I'm sitting there going, all right, you go 20 feet. The corridor continues on. Well, we go 20 more feet. Okay. Well, 20 more feet. And the corridor goes on. Well, we go 20 more feet. Okay. Well, you go 20 more feet. And there's a door 10 feet ahead to the left. And the corridor is on. We go 10 feet. Okay. We look to the left. There's a door. The corridor goes on. I mean, but that's, I think I just destroyed every listener's head that was here. But the morgue is what helped me, and I didn't know what it was called then, but I did the same when I was maps, when right. I was trying to create maps of lands. I would look up medieval maps.
One thing that I would have to caution against from experience, if you're going to be using, basically borrowed artwork or graphics or what have you, to use as visual aids for your players, try to avoid anything that's recognizable.
Yeah.
Hey, that bartender is Jizzet Norden.
Yeah, or my mistake that I made was I was running a campaign, and the group was fighting a bunch of giant insects of some sort. I grabbed a picture off the internet, cropped it down, thought I had taken out everything that was recognizable, showed it to them, and they said, oh, Starship Troopers. And from that point on, the campaign was Starship Troopers in D&D.
Right.
There was no going back.
Right. Well, I said for inspiration. So
yeah. Right. I think Dan was at least partially talking about using it as visual aids.
I would agree with you. Are correct. But I would agree that what you are describing is something that you must be careful about because of the fact that if you take something that's too recognizable or has an obvious feature that is irrelevant to your setting, like it's a room and there's a glowing sword in one corner and that's not in your room, and they're going to become fixated on that. I mean, there is some danger in doing that.
Well, where's the sword? I mean,
there is no glowing sword.
Which is why, I think there can be
a search check.
There can be a role to these visual elements. I think my personally preferred approach would be to use what Mikey's calling the morgue, or I describe just as the walkabout, of just learn how to just train yourself to start noticing the distinction details and things. If you think dungeons are all pretty much do you go right or left, take a tour of an actual cave sometime. Pay attention to what that place looks like. You may walk through a corridor where there's nothing of note, but I guarantee you, if this cave is worth seeing, if it was worth your admission price to get into, each chamber is different. I mean, there is something really distinct about each place within that cave.
Walk through a cubicle farm.
Yes.
Every cube is designed exactly the same. Every desk looks exactly the same. And yet everyone is unique as you walk past it, because the person that sits there is unique.
And watch good movies that are specific to your setting or genre, and note what they note visually and audibly. You can't note what they do from smell, but you can see how they depict touch and how they depict visually and audibly smell, if that is possible, and taste. But what's important when they're building tension, if that's what you want to build, or when they're trying to lull you into a sense of complacency, or when they're just trying to expose you to what a room is like. When you're watching Lord of the Rings and they show you the Shire for the first time, what do you see? You see farmers, you see grass, you see kids playing, you see lots gently of flowers, gently rolling hills. The windows are round. The whole thing, everything gives you a sense of roundness.
Yeah.
And there's nothing jagged. There's not a single jagged anything in that image. If that's what the kind of environment you want to put in your game, pirate it in a good way. I mean, you know, borrow liberally. Tom Stoppard or any one of 100,000 sources are attributed with the quote, you know, genius is the art of concealing one's sources.
Right.
And I believe that. Borrow. But, I mean, be responsible about it. Don't poison your campaign into Starship Troopers D&D.
Take it, break it, and make it your own.
Sure.
You know, find something you like, figure out why you like it, use those, and make your own thing.
Give it a different paint job, use some hot glue, and put some flowers on it so they're not like, oh, Unicron.
Sparkle's important. Glitter solves all problems.
Oh, it starts many others.
You come home from a strip club. Glitter causes more problems than it solves.
If your problem was that you're looking for a new home, then yes.
Problem solved.
Yeah. I have young daughters, so my house is coated in glitter at all times.
Are you training strippers?
I was going to say, that's your job as a dad, dude. No. You're failing as a father.
Well... I can't tell that story on the mic. Yeah.
But you're going to off.
Maybe for a future bonus episode, you can think about how to G-rate it in the meantime. Kyle, I hope we did a good job of answering your question, and I hope we provided something a little bit useful to everyone out there in Fear the Bootland. I want to thank you guys for tuning in. I want to thank Mikey and Johan yet again for stopping by to visit us, our monthly visitor and our official comedian.
We want to thank Chad for not being here.
Hopefully the audio works this time.
You had to bring that up.
Well, last time, this one doesn't involve Skype, so I have confidence we will have the audio for this Johan episode. So,
and for that, we thank Chris for not being here.
Yes. For that, we thank Chris for not being on the mics and potentially ruining our show. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time on, I believe it will be the last episode we record before Gen Con. I think it's going to be actually released during or right after Gen Con. So don't forget also to tune in on This Just In from Gen Con to catch us there, because we will be doing at least one episode with them. So, and also they'll have some great con coverage, which I don't know how much we're going to be doing this year, but we will still definitely be doing the social events. So thank you guys for tuning in. For some of you, we'll see you at Gen Con in short order. For the rest of you, we will catch you on the next episode.
Later days.
See ya.
God.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com.
You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.